Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a higher performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Hello, everybody. Welcome to State of Readiness, fireside chat. I'm your host, Joseph F. Paris, Jr. With me today, I have Steve Wozniak. Steve, I met Steve, about a year ago, but believe it or not, I didn't make the connection when I met him that he was one of the first people that bought a copy of my book on the internet when it was first released in May of 2017. It wasn't until the conference where we were sitting with one another and he made comment that he had bought it when it first came out. How are you doing today, Steve?
I am doing great, Joe. How are you?
Good, thanks. We met for the first time just over a year ago, if I'm not mistaken, at the Business Transformation and Operational Excellence Summit in Orlando. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's where we met.
Yeah. That was a good time. And I understand that you met Josie Perez this time around.
Yes, just last month. Yep.
Excellent. Excellent. You gave a talk there, correct?
I did. And gave a talk on creating a winning culture by leading with fundamentals.
It seems like culture is a hot topic with you, and we'll get into that in a little bit more detail later on in the program. But what I'd like to start off with, because I got to tell you, when I was with you at BTOS, you and I, hung out quite a bit, and we had some very, very interesting conversations, and I find you to be an incredibly fascinating individual. I'm very happy to have you on the show today.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, my pleasure. One of the things that really fascinated me is your linguistic skills and how you came to become aware of them. I tell people here in Germany, I've been in Germany almost 9 years, and I can't speak a lick of it. Every time I try, they jam it into English immediately. And what it sounds like in my head is not what comes out of my mouth, and neither of which a German can understand. So I'm, uniquely envious of people that can pick up language skills, because it's just something that is beyond my ability. That and hitting the lob wedge. So can you share with the audience a little bit about that story?
Well, I've been studying foreign language. English is my first language since I was in eighth grade. I started with French, and I took that through high school. So I had, by the time I was done with high school, I had 5 years of French, a couple of years of Spanish, and a year of Latin. And language just always fascinated me, came fairly easily to me. Then I had this opportunity. After my first couple of years of college, I actually went into the United States Air Force, and I had an opportunity to work as a linguist and interpreter and translator for the Air Force. And I was able to apply those skills there as well. Later on in my career, I actually had a stint working a total of 8 years in Mexico, where I found out that my Spanish was good, but I had studied Spanish up to that point. I really learned it when I was in Mexico and immersed myself in it. But I find language fascinating, just the fact that there are multiple languages around the world. Also the fact that they really tell a story of the culture as you really get to learn a language, especially when you learn the different idioms and the different types of jokes. Like when I was in Mexico, it was funny, a lot of the idioms and jokes were related around agriculture and farming, which you would not get for the idioms and jokes you'd find in New York, where I grew up. So I just always found, and still do find, language fascinating. I also, at one point in time when I was working in China, took some Mandarin Chinese classes with my son. And now that was challenging. That's a language I will never speak, at least fluently. I did get to the point where I had some conversations with folks in China, and One, I'm fairly sure it was very painful for them. And two, I am fairly certain we were talking about the same thing. But I always think it's important to know at least some of the language someplace where you're going. One, I think it's one, respectful, but two, it helps break down barriers when you're working in countries that speak different languages.
When I came to Germany, I had every intent of learning German. I bought the Rosetta Stone. I was going through that. But some of the words in German are unwieldy, to say the least. I mean, they might have, 40, 50 characters in a single word. And to pronounce it, you have to think about it. I mean, I'm envious of the Germans that can actually just do it. I have a friend that spent here years in Germany, and his thing on Facebook is to make up some ridiculously long German names or words. And honestly, I tried to speak it, but everybody here, as soon as I would utter a word of German, they would jam it into English. I mean, it's you can't even attempt it because nobody gives you the opportunity to. So I understand about the appreciation, the respect, in the, in a country, but man, they make it darn hard sometimes if you especially when they're trying to use their English.
Well, sometimes you just have, I think if you keep trying, it's worth it. When I first started working in Mexico, I would have the same thing. I'd start talking in Spanish, and people would speak to me in English that I thought was worse than my Spanish, but apparently it wasn't. And but I remember once it was. Here's a funny story for you. I remember once I was out sick, and I basically had a bad sinus infection. I said, you know what? When I go back, they're going to ask me what it was. I'm going to know how to say sinus infection in Spanish when I go back. And so I look it up in the dictionary. I look up infection. I look up sinus. Got it. Go in the next day. Sure enough, we're talking, and they say, oh, you're out. What was up? I said, and I told them that. I told them I said I had an infección de mis senos, and they all looked at me really funny. Now, I in the dictionary, infección is infection, senos is sinus. But what I had told them was I had a breast infection. So, and you just have to have fun with that and not get embarrassed and not let it knock you down. But it was a good learning experience of just being able, not being afraid to say things wrong. Because I think a lot of times when you're talking, you're thinking too much. And that makes it a little more painful for the people that are listening. If you don't worry about making, as soon as you get over the hump of worrying about making mistakes, you start getting a little more conversant, and people are help you more rather than shut you down.
Well, geez, I don't know that anybody's ever claimed that I think too much. So that can't be the problem. Oh, dear. So, I want one of the very fascinating things I learned about you when we met is that you and your brother, and I understand that you're a lead on this development, just to have a dig at your brother there, I guess, is that the reason that popcorn is so popular is because of you and your brother.
Okay, that's there's I helped. I was part of that whole wave of microwave popcorn. Remember in the 80s, those of you who remember in the 80s when microwave popcorn first came out, not all of the kernels popped. It was actually pretty bad. And there was a the mechanism to pop the popcorn was very hard to attain. They were using an industry. It was a metallized plastic film, and the industry that metallized plastic film in the past did potato chip bags, did Mylar balloons, did wrapping paper. It was very low, wide open tolerance. But the same technology applied to microwave popcorn required it to be very tight tolerance, and nobody could measure it. I mean, here, you have this thing flying through a machine at, 1,200, 1,500 feet a minute. It's got a aluminum being melted and evaporated in a cloud up onto it to a very tight tolerance. And so I got involved with the first company that had a really good vision about, if I could just get something that measures good, I can lead this industry. So let me go find somebody who could make something that could measure well. And then I got involved in that industry, and I just happened, my knack at the time was I was doing software development. And the first thing I did was I said, okay, let's see what you got. Let me put some software on it and see if I could make it better. And it turns out I could make it better, but it still wasn't good enough. So then I said, okay, now I've got to make my own optical system that measures these optical properties of this metallized film. And I was really good at the software, and I was really good at defining what had to get done. But my brother was better at coming up with the electronics and the controls behind the optical measurement. So I enlisted him. He was still in his senior year of college, so it was good part-time work for him and a couple of buddies. But we came up with a rudimentary version, and then he graduated, came on board, and we came up with a really slick version, which to this day is probably one of the most accurate systems in the field. As a matter of fact, we installed our first system in the 80s, and that one of the first systems we have is still in operation at a company today in Canada.
That's amazing. Now, were there uses for this invention beyond popcorn?
Yes, there were. Because the making microwave popcorn pop was really cool, because that you got to see what you were doing applied around the world wherever you went. But the other place you got to see it was in window films. Window films had, if you didn't run them right, if you looked on a big building with window films, you can see light and dark spots on them because it wasn't perfectly uniform. So this technology also allowed for window films to be better or have a higher yield. So a lot of this technology was all around yield improvements, and so you didn't have to sort, because people were sorting up to this point. So people that had this technology were able to essentially go to market and be able to offer something at a much more competitive price and make more money with it. So it was a very fun time for about, I'd say 3, 4, 5 years filling a niche market, and then we actually wound up selling the technology to a company that made the machines that metallized film. So they bought the rights to the technology.
So, walk me through how your system worked in the popcorn. How this,
So if you looked at a popcorn bag, and even to this day, a microwave popcorn bag, if you look inside, there's a little square gray patch. It's on the side that it's on the side that you put down in the microwave. And it's a metallized piece of film, but it's very interesting. It's the film has to be right on the edge of being a continuous and non-continuous film to capture the microwaves and get hot. And if it's too much, it doesn't work. If it's too little, it doesn't work. It has to be just right. And so that heats up sort of like the frying pan that you'd throw the oil and the kernels in, right? It heats up with the popcorn kernels there just like a frying pan and pops the kernels right in the bag. And as they pop, obviously they expand the bag because they increase the space they take up. But the trick there was that little patch that nobody ever notices is the secret to making all that popcorn pop. And if it is not just right, it doesn't work. And the systems that we had developed and put in place, the people that adopted those systems back in the late 80s found themselves able to, one, have good statistical data on what they were delivering to their customer. We did map rolling of the quality of these big rolls of film. And just to get a picture in your head, these rolls of film, think of a roll of Saran wrap that's about 6 feet wide and 60,000 feet long. And that's and all being metallized. So over that entire roll, you had to know that everything was good, and if there was something that was bad, you had to know exactly where it was, and that's sort of what our systems did.
Wow, amazing. That's amazing. Now, after you sold you and your brother sold your business, you went to work for the man, right?
I did. I sort of was playing around doing things for about a year, and eventually my wife told me, you need to go get out of the house. And so I had this gig came up in Mexico that I said, oh, working in Mexico. I mean, it was just across. I was in San Diego, so Mexico's right across the border. I didn't have to move to Mexico. I just drove in and out each day. And but I had this gig, and I said, you know, that would be pretty cool working in Mexico. Let me go. I'll go try that for a year. And it was, and this was a company that was global. They had multiple divisions, plants all around the world. And I'll tell you, I've had a number of businesses of my own, and I've worked, worked for the man or worked for companies. And I would say that the biggest difference is probably that, there are certain things, no matter what level you're at, there are certain things you have to ask permission for. That's, or you have to get buy-in beyond, it's my idea, I'm going to run with it. Now there are, as you move up the chain of command, there's less of that. But other than that, I would say that the same approach I bring to any businesses I have is the approach I bring where I've worked for a company as an employee.
Okay, so what types of companies? I mean, you can name them if you want. You'd not name them if you want. But what types of companies have you worked for in your career?
Well, the one in Mexico, the global company, was a company called Bornes. They do potentiometers and encoders and controls, sensors and controls. And in that company, my initial role was as a project engineer, and I eventually wound up running a production operation there of about 450 people in that plant. And one of the benefits I had there was being able, because we had plants around the world, I was able to travel to different plants and benchmark and bring best practices back. So that was pretty good, and they supported that quite well. And it was also my first formal introduction to lean. I've been practicing lean my whole career, is just the way I think, but someone put a name on it and some structure to it. And we brought in some consultants, were able to work that at Bourne's to with yielding phenomenal results. From Bourne's, I went on and I took all everything I had learned working in operations there and lean and all the benchmarking I had done, and I went into consulting, and I consulted for companies like Medtronic. I consulted for companies that were joint ventures with Polaroid at the time, a company called Rainbird that does the irrigation systems, and all of those were on the operations side, whether it be supply chain, quality, cross-border logistics, and in that consulting world, working for these different clients I had. I worked across the U.S., predominantly China and Asia and Mexico. And then when I was feeling like these engagements were fun, but they were kind of short, I didn't have that those long-term projects that I can work like I had when I was at Bourne's, I left that and came to my current company, which is Green Group Industries, which is a 100-plus-year-old company. Fourth generation running it, and it's a contract manufacturer of precision metal parts. And my role in that company has gone from engineering management to program management, where I'm front facing with the customer, working on with customers, helping them solve their problems. And then I also have the role of vice president operational excellence there, working on organizational alignment and overall improvement of competitive advantage throughout the entire group and all of our locations.
And According to the information you provided me, they have three locations: California, where you're located, and by the way, San Diego. Is it always like 72 and sunny there, like they say?
It very close.
Man,
it is. Today it might be 68 and sunny. So
yeah, oh man, they would break out the winter jackets, and in Michigan and in Pennsylvania. So you have three locations, but you have 300 people. So the spirit of the company must be fairly entrepreneurial for it to be, just have 300 or so employees and be 100-plus years old.
Extremely. Very, very focused. There's very little we do that's in the commodity type of market. We're typically... In our Pennsylvania facility, we do a lot of high volume, mostly defense related work, and there's a lot of it's very equipment driven. So, and they do really well on their own. We sort of leave them alone. They've been doing the same thing for decades, and we can only mess them up. So we leave them alone. In Michigan and Oceanside, a lot of the work we do is work that oftentimes is work other people don't want or have or can't do. So we're constantly working on developing skill sets that make us desirable to work with when people have something that is very difficult, trick, or complex to do.
Okay. And I'm seeing that one of the things that you do, and probably either your California or Michigan plant, maybe your PA plant too, I guess, is CNC machining. Now, I'm thinking about, additive manufacturing. Are you guys getting into that at all? 3D printing, as it's commonly called?
Yes. We actually have expansion plans in the next 18 months, which include creating space for additive manufacturing, doing metal additive manufacturing. And we've been investigating this now for a couple of years. We have dipped our toe in some additive manufacturing equipment, but we're on the plastic side of the. We pretty much do everything for tooling and fixtures now. We're doing that now. On the metal side, that technology is still improving. They're still on the steep part of the learning curve, so we're keeping an eye on folks, and we're looking at at what point do we actually want to invest in some of the equipment? Because the equipment we're looking at now you'd want to invest in, by the time it's on the floor, it's working and everything, I mean, you got $1 million investment. It's not like one of these $100,000 machines.
Right.
But we do see a great future for that, for prototyping and low volume production of metal parts.
At a client in the aerospace industry, and I was amazed to find out that they're making fan blades for jet engines out of, by 3D printing or additive manufacturing. And, I'm thinking about the tolerances and the stress, of those things are running at supersonic. And, the tolerances and stress that those pieces, endure to be manufactured in that way it really has come a long way in a fairly short amount of time.
And it's growing in leaps and bounds now too. One of the things that we're always looking at is because we're a contract manufacturer, we have to be prepared to make many different types of parts and change on a dime and make changes. For something like a fan blade, or if we were making one part, we would have bought a machine already and fine-tuned it for that one part and made it work that one part. And we probably would have done most of the engineering in-house. Right now, we're sort of waiting for all of the additive manufacturing equipment companies to do a little more of the engineering for us before we buy.
Before we take a break here, I want to talk to you about your latest venture, and I think this is with your brother also, is L&M Instruments.
That's correct.
Okay, and company size is two people, so I'm going to assume that the second person is your brother. Can you share with the audience a little bit about that and how you
sure.
got into it?
It's a fun story. If you know the original company that made the optical monitoring systems for the microwave popcorn was Wozzeck Technology, and that was in the late 80s, early 90s, and I sold that in 1992. And so fast forward 20 years to 2012, my brother gives me a call and he says, "Hey, remember that stuff we used to build? We had big rack mount cabinets and cables all over the place and power supplies." He says, "We could make that same thing now, and you hold it in your hand and it plugs in a USB port on a computer." So in 2012, we just started a fun project, brother to brother, of coming up with this cool thing and finding making one that works just almost as a fun project to do. Lo and behold, it turned out to be pretty good. Actually, probably better than what we were making in the 80s and 90s. And as definitely in size it was. And so I said, this is a pretty cool technology, but I don't want to go start a company again. At least let's go find someone that can sell this stuff for us. And I said, you know what? I know a guy that from 20 years ago that was a marketing guy in this field. Let me try to track him down. And I did. Well, it turns out this marketing guy is now CEO of a company that needs a complete refresh of their technology, of their optical measurement technology. So, next thing you know, a year later, we take our technology and we're licensing it. And we're still licensing it. I think we're in our fifth or sixth year with this particular company. And we decided we liked the licensing path, develop technology and license it. So that's what we're doing. And so we have the high-end optical, and now we're working on environmental monitoring that is IoT based.
Awesome. That's awesome. And your plans with that is to develop additional technology and just license it to
Correct.
whomever has a need for it. Super. That's super.
Correct.
All right. So we're going to take a break. I'm Joseph Paris, and you're listening to State of Readiness with Steve Wozniak. We'll take a break and be right back. This episode of State of Readiness, sponsored by the Readiness Institute, the leading education center for companies who want to create an organization that recognizes time as the enemy of the 21st century company and knows the competitive advantage will go to the company that can see further beyond the horizon, recognize opportunities and threats more quickly, has achieved a superior level of operational excellence, and possesses the organizational capacity and capability to devise and deploy decisive responses faster than the competition and even the marketplace, all the while maintaining control of the narrative, and has become the high-performance organization. Welcome back. This is Joe Paris, and with me today I have Steve Wozniak. Steve, how you doing? You still there?
I'm still here, Joe.
All right, super. I had made mention at the beginning of the podcast that you and I met at BTOS, and you were a speaker this year at BTOS, and your talk was "Winning Culture by Leading with Fundamentals." Could you tell me a little bit about, or share with the audience a little bit about your talk?
Sure. The whole concept behind the creating a winning culture by leading with fundamentals is coming up with a way that and a methodology that you can work through that helps ensure that decisions made at every level of your organization are either going to safeguard or improve your competitive advantage. And part of this backs into some organizational alignment, but there are some very simple steps that I've found that when I use, they're very successful. And when I've been successful in the past, when I look back in retrospect, I was doing this, maybe not recognizing I was doing it, but it was just sort of natural. So I thought in this talk, I would take this approach that I dissected and figured out what I was doing and share it. And so you have I look at this leading with fundamentals. I break it down into these three steps. One step is, and these three steps are applied to every level of the organization. And your organization, just to define it, could be a global organization, a division, a plant, a department. It could even be a process. You can define organization however you want, and this works. But the three steps were: make sure everybody understands the three states of business relative to competitive advantage, and I have a very simple way of doing this. Create an awareness and understanding of some basic fundamentals that everybody's read in a book, everybody has seen them before, but often they just forget to think about them. And then the other one is taking a look at the strategy that your business has and coming up with three fundamentals that embody that strategy that in a way that is effective and productive for your organization. So as you change organizations, you're going to have to think about this a little. You're going to have to fine-tune these fundamentals for your organization. And then the key then is to make everybody in that organization not only aware of them, but understand them. And these particular fundamentals are ones that you would make sure are included and part of all of your training, your onboarding, you're tying meetings to them, so that they become this common theme, this alignment tool for everybody around decision making and to help people focused. And you have any questions so far?
Yeah, I was going to say, what are the fundamentals universal?
The basic business fundamentals are universal. The three fundamentals that you would tie to your strategy are not. They are very unique to your organization. You have to design them around your organization.
And what are some of the we'll call it design factors, for lack of a better term, what goes into designing these fundamentals that are unique to a company?
There, what goes into them is when you're looking at what you're trying, you have to really understand what you're trying to achieve and your end game. And I'll give you a for instance, with the Wyzak technology, the microwave popcorn company. When I go back and I look at what my three fundamentals were for the people that worked at my company at that time, that guided everything we did and decisions we made, they were, we need to satisfy our customers. Every system has to perform the same worldwide, and all products must be easy to use, no manual required. And when I talked to this, I was like, when you look at this, it's like, wow, when you said that we're going to come up with three fundamentals, I probably wasn't thinking of something like this. So this is sort of the fundamentals basically break down into three points that are almost like a mission statement. But there's three of them, and I have a reason of picking three, not less, not more. And it has to do with syllogisms. Are you familiar with those, Joe?
No, syllogisms.
Yes. So syllogisms, I'm going to talk about it, and then you're going to remember it because you probably took it in a class at one point in time. That's where you have a major premise, a minor premise, and conclusion. It's
Okay, yeah.
how we deductively reason, basically.
Okay.
And so that these three fundamentals would be your major premises. Your minor premise would be this decision path you're thinking of. You would challenge that decision path to each of those three fundamentals, and then your conclusion would be, is this going to be a good decision or a bad decision? And the reason I have three is that one doesn't always work, and I'll give you an example. An example of a syllogism would be, let's say, all people are good, Aristotle is a person, Aristotle is good.
Okay.
But if you only have the one, you can have all people are good, thieves are people, thieves are good. That's not a good conclusion. So what I've found over time is if you have one, you're going to have a lot of iffy decisions or bad decisions. If you have two, it gets better, but not quite good enough. Three, you start getting to the point where better than 80% of your decisions are good decisions relative to safeguarding or improving your competitive advantage. And when it comes to people, if you start doing four or more, people just stop making decisions. So I go with three.
So at four or more, the process just becomes so, we'll call it, the overhead is so intense that nobody executes. And,
Yeah, there's
yeah.
just too many
It's like
things
having
to.
20, yeah. It's like having 20 people in a meeting when three will do.
Right. And
Yeah.
the other thing is, now when you get to all this artificial intelligence people are doing, you could have as many as you want. But I do think when you stick to three, it really helps keep the focus. And for so one of the things I had a one of the things I did in the operation when I worked in Mexico to help do it, the fundamentals I picked, and again, you're going to realize these when you're saying fundamentals, these aren't things that you would normally that would normally come to your head when you're saying, wow, what are these fundamentals I'm going to come up with for my strategy? But the one in Mexico was good customer perception is important. Positive trends are mandatory. Avoid them and they use names. And all of those are in all of the training, the way you talk, the way you onboard, and your decision-making process. And these are simple things that you can take to every level of your organization, and it just works.
Now, you've worked abroad. You've worked in, several companies in several countries.
Yes.
And I think that puts you at a unique advantage over most business leaders when it comes to culture, because you have not been hermetized. My father worked at IBM, and from 1961 to when he retired, some 25 years or so later. And at the time at IBM, everybody wore a white shirt and a tie and a jacket. I mean, it was required. I mean, this was the culture of IBM. It was very insular. Everybody had to think and act and be the same. But you can't be that way when you're working abroad. And so can you share some of the experiences of being exposed to these different cultures and how they might have affected the way you engage people?
Well, certainly. And so cultural sensitivity is something I thought I had until I had to have it. And so a lot of when you go into another country, I mean, you try to learn as much as you can about, the generalities of the culture, just so you at least have a framework to work within. But then what you're really looking for is to the people that you're working with to try to initially create that rapport and that relationship with them where you can ask culture type of questions so that you understand what's acceptable and what's not. Because especially coming from the United States and growing up in New York, I can very easily be culturally insensitive. And so when I went to Mexico, you learned you what you did is you had to be very aware and watch and listen. And then you also had to be able to take feedback. And sometimes that feedback would come in the form of someone being really mad at you because you did something that was culturally insensitive, and you just better had to take it and move forward with it. And then as time goes on and you go to more of these places, you sort of you that sensitivity level starts going up because you're able to see things now that you couldn't see before because you're learning more. And I've had experiences in China where when I initially got my initial foray into China was to go help somebody launch a product that was way behind. And I went in there with my get things done hat on and immediately found that was the wrong hat to wear to get things done in China. And there's a there's a culture there of people need to save face. You can't insult somebody, and somehow you have to allow people to save face, not insult somebody, and hold them accountable. And so you had to learn strategies to do that were acceptable. And then what I really found over time going between Mexico, China, Scotland, Ireland, Costa Rica, Japan, Canada, United States, and any place I've been is that if you really just sit back and focus on respecting the people in the country you're going to and respecting their culture, and even if you don't know it, but wanting to respect it and truly doing it not just to be productive, but to be respectful, that ability to be productive and and happy in a different culture starts coming a lot faster.
And it's a lot more fun, isn't it? Don't you find it much more enjoyable?
I do, and I love meeting new people and learning new things about just the person themselves, where they're from, their background, and when you start taking that approach in places, that works a lot better than, just trying to keep it all business.
Right. So, when you go someplace, you eat what they eat, you drink what they drink.
I do, and
Yeah.
yeah, and I'm very fortunate. I'm not a picky eater because there are some places I've been where that would not have worked real well.
Yeah, I draw the line at bugs. I just can't, I mean, I haven't been to a place that requires or has the opportunity. Well, I guess that's untrue, right? There's ch chocolate covered ants. I wouldn't eat a chocolate covered ant. I don't care if it's Lindt chocolate. I'm not going to eat a chocolate covered ant.
Well, yes, I've eaten bugs.
You're a
Yes, I've
better
eaten
man than
snake.
I.
Yes, I mean, there were some things. Now, granted, I may have had it once and said, "Okay, I've tried it. I'm done. I don't need to do that again." But
Okay, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. I find that the places I go, everybody wants to introduce me to their local rot gut, and that usually ends up poorly.
Yeah, I have been fortunate that the places I've been, I the drink there has been okay. I think I probably had a tougher time with good old down south moonshine in the United States than I have with any of the drink that had been offered me in other countries.
Well, you being of Polish heritage, I don't know if you ever been introduced to a spiritus, but that's jet fuel, that stuff. That's
I have
you have a
not, and one day you'll introduce me to it.
Yeah, I had a shot of it once, and you could literally feel it going through your veins. You could feel it going down to your gut. And then through your veins, and nothing good can happen from that. But I do agree with you that if you're empathetic and make the effort to understand the people and their culture, goes a long way because then it also drives their business feelings and their business goings on. So it's not just about, going and eating, good food and living like Anthony Bourdain, right? It's about how do we convert that newfound wisdom to better understand the context in which a business is operating.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And in each country I've went to, there's a lot of things that look the same when you walk through the door, but they work different.
Yeah. And do you also find that even within a company, you have, and I'm not even talking about different divisions across the world, but even within a company, the culture of individual silos can be a challenge. And then to horizontally integrate that organization, even if it's your single site, how do you get to understand the dynamics of a corporate culture?
Good question. Well, one, when you're looking at you will see different cultures in different teams, different departments, different divisions, different plants. And this could all be in the same city, in the same town, and even everybody's from the same town. You'll have different cultures across that. And I think what you need to do is recognize when those differences in culture between the different areas is a productive thing, and when it's not productive. And because you don't want everybody to be the same. That's not that that's that's not good either.
Right. If everybody's thinking the same, then nobody's thinking, right? Is that the saying?
Exactly. I mean, it's you want to capture the synergies of these different subcultures you'll have throughout your organization. But what you do want is you want that top-level culture to be consistent. So I think what you work on first is making sure that top-level culture is and the expectations. You could work it through those other business fundamentals, your vision, your mission, your values that you're constantly telling people you want, that this is how we operate, this is what we're doing, this is where we're going, and making sure people understand as a business, your core competencies, strategic excellence positions, your critical success factors. You have this one, it's a top level, but really it's the foundation that all these other cultures operate on. And if you use that as the yardstick to know if these cultures are being are productive or counterproductive to what you're trying to accomplish, then you can go in and you start making adjustments. But I think the way you make those adjustments is not, we're so quick to change processes and then train people, or go in and tell people what to do as management or leadership. When I think if you go back to those other three fundamentals we were talking about earlier, that's the type of thing where you'd look at it, let's say a culture that's not being very productive, and you'd look at what they need to get productive, because at the end of the day, everybody wants to do a good job. Nobody's trying to do a bad job. And then come up with these three fundamentals that you can say, hey guys, listen, this is what we want to focus on. And once you have them understanding that and bought into those, you'll start seeing, you normally start seeing something morph into something that's more productive for where the company wants to go and how it wants to get there.
So one of the things that you said there is that, you want to have people that are going to represent a wide spectrum of culture, different point of views. You said something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. But oftentimes we hear people not getting a job because they didn't fit the corporate culture. All right. So I could understand, having differences of perspective. So would it be more, or should it be better to make sure that an employee or a prospective employee shares the corporate values, not necessarily the culture? And maybe HR should rethink their syntax?
Good point, because when a lot of times when you have a really good candidate, but they're just not the right fit, I'll use the word fit.
Good.
You can say, well, they wouldn't fit, and what are they not fitting into? That's pretty ambiguous often. But a lot of times it comes down to whether or not you think the person is, one, you want them to have the values your company has. If they don't have the values, that's an easy one
right,
to say no. But it's also not an easy one to know ahead of time before they come in. That's
right.
But the fit side, what you are doing, and again, this comes back to, tweaking some of these cultures, you're looking at what you're trying to accomplish with a company and where you want to take it. So as in leadership, when you're looking down at that, when you're looking across the organization, you're saying you're looking for where your strengths and weaknesses are, and where the weaknesses are, you're saying, what do I need there? And when you're hiring that person, that lack of fit or that not going to fit the culture or fit the culture really has to do with what you're looking for there. I think there's that soft requirement that you're not going to find in a resume or in a job description is what people are really talking to there.
Right. If you're going to get along with your colleagues, for whatever along means.
Yeah, you'll hear a good team player, or they'll fit on the team, they'll work. But at the end of the day, there's, and a lot of times people don't even realize they're looking for it. Now, hopefully they're conscious that they're trying not to hire people that think the same way they do, just because they'd be more comfortable. But they should be thinking, we need to hire someone because I need to get this done, and I need this piece of my puzzle on that team from, and not from a, maybe not from a skill standpoint, maybe not from an experience standpoint, but from a mindset standpoint.
Right. Well, listen, we're coming to the top of or the end of our time here, and I have a couple of call it rapid fire questions here. Are you ready?
Go for it.
All right. So, the easy one here. What personal habit contributes to your success?
I would say the best habit I have is I am always reflecting on how I'm doing. I'd like to say I'm pretty good at looking in the mirror and seeing the uglies as well as the good things. And if I'm not seeing enough things that I think I need to improve, I'll go ask for them. But I always want to be very aware of my strengths and weaknesses, so that I know what I need to work on, and I also know where I need to go ask for help for things.
You know, it's interesting that you talked about asking for help because most people don't do that. Most people will actually say, "Find my weaknesses and fix my weaknesses." Well, sometimes the fix is not from within. You know, sometimes we have to augment them. Like I said, I'll never be able to hit a lob wedge, so I got my 7 iron and I just, bump and run. That's how I compensate for an inability that I have. And so I think sometimes our ego gets in the way. We have to fix this. Well, we don't have to necessarily fix it from within. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I agree. I think I have had an opportunity to work with awesome people throughout my career that that I have grown from knowing them. I've learned from them, and they're people that I would still call to lean on because they're really good at something I'm just not going to get good at.
Yeah,
That's
exactly
that.
right. Exactly right. I can't use this example on you because you do invent things, but I tell people that the chances of me inventing something are virtually zero. So close to zero that if I don't know it, it means it already exists out there. All I have to do is find it. You, on the other hand, of course, will just invent it. So what's the best piece of advice you ever received?
Best piece of advice I've ever received was probably get to the point in as few words as possible. In my early career as an engineer, I was quite verbose, and what I want to tell somebody typically came at the end of a very long description of what I was about to tell them.
Yeah. I think I blame our education system for that, by the way. It's like, how many 500 word essays did we have to write? Why did it have to be 500 words? What if I could get everything across in 100 words or 50 words? But no, we're trained early on to bulk it up.
Yeah, it so and that has served me well because I just going through this podcast, I it's very easy for me to talk, so I have to be very conscious about when I shouldn't.
Well, you've done a wonderful job. I think that this has been a very, very smooth and fun-filled podcast. A lot of good stories, a lot of good anecdotes, a lot of good life lessons. So the last question I have for you is, who is the one leader you look up to most and why?
Well, I really don't have one person that I would look up to. There are just too many people out there to that have great stories just to pick one. However, if I were to look at, there's a group of people that just always keep me in awe, and that's the founding fathers of the USA, the United States of America. I think it's an example of a great leadership team. They're a diverse group of people who came together based on common ideals and beliefs. They created a vision. They declared independence. They created a framework for a government. And all of this framework is still in place and relevant centuries later. I mean, there aren't too many, when I look back, I look for people that came up with something or did something that has staying power. And so if you're looking for recent leaders, a lot of them have good stories, good ideas, but you don't know if they have staying power yet. So I like to look back to the ones that have staying power. And in our founding fathers, one of the things I found that was very great was just the diversity. I thought the diversity was the key. You had everything from formally educated to self-taught, fairly wealthy to just getting by. You had businessmen, philosophers, politicians, writers. I think without this diversity, the USA wouldn't exist as it does today. So.
I agree with you, by the way, 100%. What I find particularly interesting is that any one of them, by themselves, we might not have ever heard of. My personal favorite out of that group is Thomas Jefferson. But if it wasn't for everybody else, we might not have ever heard of Thomas Jefferson. So for some strange reason, these people they're met at a confluence of history. You know what I mean? I think that's actually the remarkable story behind the story is that, what are the odds of these individuals coming? And, in our time, you're in my time, it happened similarly, in the early 80s with, in my opinion, of course, with Reagan, Thatcher, Gorbachev, and Pope John Paul the First. And, if those individuals didn't meet at that moment in history, what would the history have been?
No, agreed.
So out of the founding fathers, I tipped my hand and said, TJ, do you have a favorite founding father?
I'd say if I had to pick one, I would go with Ben Franklin.
Ben Franklin.
I think he was, for me, in reading history, the closest thing to a linchpin for that entire group.
Very good. Very good. Well, Steve, thank you for sharing your time and wisdom with me and in my audience. It's been a great pleasure having you on board State of Readiness.
Thank you for having me, Joe. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. So, Steve Wozniak, inventor and business person extraordinaire. I'm Joseph Paris. You've been listening to State of Readiness. Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.